Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Tom Koch, adjunct professor of medical geography at the University of British Columbia. And we're talking about his latest book, Ethics in Everyday Places, Mapping Moral Stress, Distress, and Injury. Tom, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And it's nice to be back.
It is, and I'm especially interested in talking to you about this book. But first, it's finally occurred to me, and the audience should know that Tom and I have known each other from long ago and far away in a galaxy far, far away.
We called it the 60s.
The 60s, I know. And it was the time of the 60s, too. All the books we've talked about, and we've talked about two other books prior to this, and this book, has ultimately been about ethics. And I want to ask you, what led you down the road to be a person who works on ethics? Because that's a unique enterprise. I mean, we're all involved in the ethical discussions. But you decided to approach it more seriously and more academically. What led you there?
It started in the 80s when I was taking care of my father. As you know, I took care of him for 5 years and wrote the first book on elder care from the perspective of the caregiver.
Right.
And while I was doing that, one of my brothers said, well, I only visit twice a year, but I have quality time, which consisted of drinking a lot at night. Another brother said, well, I'm a busy businessman, and he came up once or twice a year. And, of course, they all wanted to deal with the money. I was, as they said, the hippie kid who could do the touchy-feely woman things.
Oh, man.
And I thought, how can you basically talk about what's right and appropriate in terms of a parent you say you love, and yet take these positions? And as I moved forward in elder care, I became involved in the 90s in debates like, should persons with Down syndrome get organ transplants?
Right.
Or are they kind of non-half people who can give but not get? And then I became involved in the whole issue of what they call today MAID, medical assistance in dying, but which I call a little more bluntly physician-assisted and directed termination. And the question of what was right and how were we to consider things like this. So my work with gerontology and then my work with chronic care carried me forward while I was also working in public health and infectious disease.
And that's carried on into your original interest in geography.
Everything is informed by my geography,
right,
in the end.
That's right.
And this this new book basically tries to bring together the work I've done in geography and in cartography in the mapping of health in place with the ethics. And my multidisciplinary PhD qualifies in medicine, philosophy, and geography. So I wanted to bring them together in a way that would not appeal necessarily to the professional in any of these fields, but would appeal to the normal person facing the type of problems where, as I call it in the book, where you, and everybody knows what this is like, where you know you've done everything right by the rules, but you also know you've done something wrong.
And as you call it, it's that queasy feeling, and everybody knows that. Everybody knows that feeling that, I did what the work told me to do, but I know it's probably not right. Before we let's start out with your definition of ethics and morals. Are they synonymous?
Most people use them synonymously. They interchangeably, rather.
Yeah.
I found it very important to separate them from the start and to say that ethics basically are codes of behavior based on the type of, on a moral set which is publicly accepted. So you may have a moral set which says that it's all right for you to go off with your gun and shoot up Main Square at high noon. Nobody else is going to accept that. They will accept an ethics which says you're a soldier, you're a policeman, there's a reason for you to be out there with a gun. But morally, we as a community set values, which are the moral structure on which we decide what is appropriate and inappropriate. And at the end of the book, what I come to is an argument that maybe that's what we've lost.
It's interesting because throughout reading your book, I kept thinking of American society right now, and especially about the gun argument that's going on right now. and how we don't seem to have a moral center in this. We seem to have two opposing moral camps.
Well, as you know, I live in Canada now.
And I deeply appreciate that all the time.
But I was born in the United States and have lived and worked in both countries. And I'm not sure that there is a different moral center. What there is an imbalance. Everybody on both sides in the United States will argue for autonomy, will argue for individual rights, will argue for individual expression. So that's not really up for debate. What is up for debate is basically what that means. Does that mean that you are free to carry a gun? Well, the Constitution doesn't say that. In fact, a lot of constitutional law argues against it, except if you're in a well-ordered militia. There is, I think, without the moral center, there is a lack of what does it mean to be a member of the community and to be afraid in your community.
Yes.
Alexis de Tocqueville in The Journey to America in 1834 did probably one of the greatest studies ever done of the United States as it evolved. And he liked the New England towns and their town meetings, but he was very worried about a nation which seemed to have no greater allegiance. He was thinking about England and the allegiance to the crown as a figurehead, as exemplars. And he talked about people, and this was when capitalism and wealth were becoming the standard by which we judge people. And he worried about people, he said, who had no allegiances and would become shut up in the solitude of their own hearts. And what has happened in America, this is not in the book, but this is my own feeling, is basically, since Reagan and Reaganomics, has been the fulfillment of his worst fears for the United States. America wants to believe it's the greatest nation in the world. It wants to believe it's the greatest this and that. It doesn't understand why other people don't agree. But American citizens are frustrated in what they owe their allegiance to and what it means to be an ethical American today. And so we splinter left, right, and center.
And it's, I think it's amazing how certain conservative religions have seemed to have strayed so far from the original messages. So we actually we seem to have a moral failing at the very basis of how people define their morals.
I think that's true. And what I come to at the end of this book, after...
Which is, by the way, one of the great finishing paragraphs of a book that I've read lately. You have a great finishing paragraph in this book. Everybody should buy the book just to read that last paragraph.
Or at least get it from their library.
No, buy the book.
Please do. MIT Press will thank you, and so will I. I come to... This is stuff I've thought about in medicine and in public health and in the debates in both of our countries for a long time. And what I come to, with a little bit of philosophy thrown in, enough to keep the other academics happy, is that what we've lost has been, in all of the debates, the sense of what it means to be a citizen.
Exactly.
We see today the kids in Florida who are acting as engaged and responsible citizens, who are advocating a philosophy in which, yes, you can own a gun, we understand that, but not any gun, and not any gun with a bandana of 20 cartridges. I don't have the full answer. I wish, if I did, I'd be talking to the wise men in Sweden, and I wouldn't be talking to you.
Right.
You'd be interviewing me after my Nobel. I wait up every year for them to call. But what we come to is precisely this, that what has been lost is what it means not to be an American, to be a citizen in the national community. So I know supporters of the current president who work in blood drives, they deliver meals on wheels, they do a lot at the level of their locality, but in terms of the nation, believe themselves totally alienated. I would say that one of the things which has made me think about this is that's not true in Canada. And that in Canada, the relation between our elected representatives and the citizens, in my experience, is much closer and much more open. Doesn't mean they're always going to answer and do what we say as individuals, but it means they're certainly going to listen to us. And so I meet periodically with my members of the provincial and the federal, the provincial legislature, the House of the Federal House. I've met with some of the federal ministers, not because I was once a reporter or because I am an esteemed academic sometimes, but because I'm a constituent with a passion in some areas that I want them to hear. And I never have trouble getting heard. That's a huge difference.
It is a huge difference. I want to focus on your book now, because there's a lot to talk about in your book.
I'm glad you liked the last paragraph, by the way.
I do. It saved me, because I didn't. A lot, so much was going on while I was reading it. It was this was a book about, and the term for this feeling that you've done everything right, but there's a feeling that you've done wrong, it's called moral distress. And the idea of moral distress, as you write about in the book, is actually fairly old.
Yes. The moral distress and injury, well, it goes way back in philosophy, and I have in the first chapter a bit of a review of it. But I tell readers, if they're not interested, they can skip that. They can come back to it later. And in classical philosophy and literature, it never ends well. The individual is basically at loggerheads with the king or with the court or with the other authorities, and is always given the choice, really, of bowing down and doing what he or she is told, or at best being banished, if not executed. A Man for All Seasons, Thomas Bolt's great right. play about Thomas More, is one of the great examples of this. And in philosophy, guys like Hegel and Kierkegaard tackle it, and they say, well, speaking academically, they say that's kind of a bitch, you know? It doesn't work out. What we have, however, today is a whole new literature on this stuff, especially since PTSD became a byword.
That's right.
But a lot of that is at an academic level or a professional level that seems to have no resonance with just the normal folk who are making maps, writing newspaper stories, having radio interviews, just the folk that we know. And I was challenged to this by a group of working cartographers at a conference who said, yeah, you know, in college I took this course about Kant and that. I didn't understand it. What's this got to do with us with this problem? How can you explain it to me? I've dealt with nurses and physicians in this area, and I tried to just lead them off with, I've dealt with this elsewhere. But then I realized it was time to look at this as a systemic national problem, a problem of morality, of our cumulative view of right and wrong, rather than as a simple problem of this profession or that first responder.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Tom Koch, adjunct professor of medical geography at the University of British Columbia, and we're talking about his latest book. It's a really interesting read, Ethics in Everyday Places, Mapping Moral Stress, Distress, and Injury. Tom, there's several great personal examples you talk about in this book, and one of them is a problem that you sort of presented to your class, the still smoking after all these years.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. What was the setup for that?
Okay. I mean, first, let me admit that academics and ethicists and philosophers aren't supposed to insert themselves into their own stories. We are supposed to be higher than that. But because I wanted to build this from the ground up, I had to build it as part of a narrative in which I was sometimes an actor. I was at a meeting of the North American Cartographic Information Society, and issues of ethics came up partly because of me. And I critiqued some maps on this basis. And afterwards, there was a lot of discussion where a lot of people challenged me to write an article about what ethics would mean for the people who are hired to make maps for newspapers or for academic journals or any of the thousands of maps which are being made each day and published in all sorts of places. And it took me about a year to write this article, and I came up with a problem in ethics for cartographers, but which could be easily transferred to demographers, statisticians, geographers, all sorts of folk. And the problem was very simple. You're the member of a small, struggling company called MapOff. You're offered, say, $100,000 by the American Tobacco Conglomerate to make an advertisement of long-lived smokers called Still Smoking After All These Years. And the data is available from the CDC, the data is available from Census.gov, on smokers of longevity. So Do you make the map and take the contract? Do you make the map and take the contract knowing that you're equating longevity with tobacco use? You do that if your mom's died of lung cancer. And if she didn't, if your uncle did, you send the map to mom and say, look what I did. And then the second part of the problem, once people have chewed on that, and I do this normally in hour or two-hour courses, is, okay, the cancer conglomerates of the world want you to make a map of long-time smokers in the United States, but do it basically for a stop smoking campaign. Same data, if you wish. What's the difference between the maps?
And I think it's important to assert here, and this is covered in your book so well, that I think a lot of people think maps obviously represent facts.
We think maps represent facts. We think statistics represent facts. We think, as one statistician said rather heatedly in one of the sessions I ran, it's just numbers. That's all I deal with. But, of course, it's never just numbers, and maps are always conclusions. One of the real insights to me in the book was when I realized that we like to think that data speaks for itself.
Right.
Data never speaks. Data is like a ventriloquist dummy sitting on our shoulder. We put the words into it, and it sounds independent. We say, here's the problem. Here's what we want to address. We look for the data that addresses the way we frame the problem and then bring it forward with all sorts of algorithms if we want and say, look, that's the world. It's the world we make, and we have chosen to argue rather than necessarily the world. The world as is a much more fluid place. And so some of this is a caution to the professionalism of the academics who like to think that they are value-free presenters of a world in which they have no part, when they're absolutely central to it.
And by the way, the way maps can be manipulated is visually they can be manipulated in an infinite number of ways to present data set in certain ways to emphasize one thing rather than another. There's a phrase in your book I love. Maps make promises they can't deliver. And people need to keep that in the back of their mind all the time.
And so do statisticians and demographers, and certainly so do journalists.
Well, what was amazing to me is when you first presented this problem to cartographers, how many people just said, look, it's the job, and the job, what the job tells me to do is what's right. And therefore,
Almost nobody.
So nobody would think that the job is what dictates what's right.
Well, a statistician said it's just numbers. You know, I just take somebody's numbers.
So it doesn't matter what the consequences are.
This was in a class for professionals, which I was teaching at the University of Regina. And I had professional statisticians and cartographers and a couple health people there. And I broke them up into groups. And this one guy says, well, look, it's no big thing. They're numbers. I work numbers. And the woman behind him leaned forward and said, so if they gave you the numbers, you wouldn't mind locating the concentration camps, you fascist son of a bitch.
Whoops.
And he turned around and he said, what, I'm going to let an earth mama like you tell me what to do?
Whoops.
These things get very heated because most people, if they say it's just numbers, they're pulling back from an area where they know that somehow they're culpable. And yet, on the other hand, it's very hard for those people to take the high road to do so without sounding as if they're being dictatorial. So most of the sessions, whether undergraduate classes or professionals, people pretty much very quickly got into the problem, partly because I said the first map you're going to get $100,000, the anti-cancer folk are going to give you $10,000. So there was immediately a financial part to all of this, and there is no answer to the problem. That is, if you don't take the contract, baby still needs new shoes.
Right.
This is how you make your living. Your 11-year-old needs braces, and your wife would really like to have you earn as much money as she gets. It's never going to happen for us, but that's okay. And so the complexity of the problem is that there was no good solution, but everybody saw the problem.
But the important thing for me I came out of this is that you need to recognize there is a problem and that you should be wrestling with it.
people pretty much saw that. When I do a class, I don't just go up and lecture. I do 3 to 4, maybe 5 minute setup, and then I ask people what they think. And so I will go around and I will say, what do you think, right in front of somebody. In one class I did this with, this tall, rather gangly fellow who didn't want to speak, came up to me afterwards and he said, you know, I kind of like this ethics stuff, but I sure don't want to read any dead Germans.
No, nobody wants to read dead Germans.
But pretty much everybody saw that, even if they weren't feeling, they all saw that this could be a problem for some. They all understood that in a commercial economy, that at times you may be asked to do something you don't believe in. And so nobody, except for the occasional statistician, said, it's just numbers, Jack. And those who did were quickly disabused of that by others in a group. It's really been a great, I mean, I've presented this in several sessions, a couple variants, different groups, mostly cartographers and statisticians. Everybody got it in the sense they were all engaged by it. And when they ask me what's right, I can only say it's what we decide together is right.
That's right.
And another thing there, in terms of our malaise as nations, is that we have to realize that these things are part of the debate that we take to structure what we believe is correct as professionals in our organizations, but also in our states and in our nations. And in some ways, that's what America is struggling with now in a very inarticulate fashion, I believe.
Well, you know, there's a quote in your book that, and you just sort of automatically say that, you know, of course we believe this, that the lives of children are the conscience of a nation. And then I think about what just happened, and I'm watching the young people face politicians, and they're confronting them with that very thing. Is it children, or you love the children, or do you love the guns more? And that's, to me, it was amazing that the people had to think about that.
It's not my line. It's quoted from one of the great writers in this area, but it's true. And if we believe that, how can we basically have public schools which are so ill-funded in the inner cores of our cities while the suburban schools are getting twice as much money per student per year?
Right.
If we believe this, how can we basically not have health care for children who are living in homes where, in areas where the pollution is so bad, 50% of the kids are using asthma inhalers, and about 15% have lead poisoning? If we believe in the future of the nation, if we believe in our citizenry, how can we do that? And part of the book is about how we look at data, and we look at maps and statistics, and are carefully trained not to see the ramifications.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. We could be talking about this book for years. It's that kind of a book.
I hope so.
There's a really interesting, in your chapter on transportation and ethics, something that really hit home to me. You were talking about the London Underground map, the famous one by Harvey Beck, which has been updated, and that what's missing from that map. And I immediately identified with that because of physical problems I have myself. And talk to me about that.
It is the London Underground map is truly iconic. It is the icon on which almost all other great subways in the world have built their maps. And it's sort of like an electronic circuitry. It's a whole series of lines and points.
Oh, it's a work of art.
Everywhere.
It's a work of art. Everybody.
It was a work of real genius, and it still is. And I've been to London a number of times to lecture and to do research. One of the benefits of being me, I must say. And I have arthritis and low vision.
Huh.
And so I'm clomping around on my cane, peering about, and going down these 19th century, these very steep steps, because there is no elevator, there is no escalator. And I'm finding it very, very difficult. There are special access stations in the map, but they're few and far between, especially in the center core. And yet, under the EU, England is supposed to be doing things for disability. London and England says that they are an open society. What does the map look like to a person in a wheelchair or who's hobbling who can only use special access, which is where an elevator is? And this is true, for instance, in Chicago.
Sure.
The elevators at the L. And
well, the point you bring up, and the reason I have to rush this on is we're down to a minute or two. The map seems to...
over 85% of the whole system is inaccessible.
That's right.
To people like me.
And it's this beautiful map that seems to promise you access to everything, but that's not true.
And so much of our world, we look like it is that. And if we believe what we're responsible as professionals, that is, as cartographers and statisticians, aren't we obliged to look beyond the data we're given to find its limits and to promote those too?
You would hope so. I mean, it's amazing. We have only scratched the surface of this book. And I want to mention there's a lot of information about defining moral philosophy and lots of other examples that are I found really fascinating. But it's the kind of book that it would take several shows to discuss fully. My returning guest tonight is Tom Koch, adjunct professor of medical geography at the University of British Columbia. And we're talking about his latest book, Ethics in Everyday Places, Mapping Moral Stress, Distress, and Injury. Tom, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.